a stinking mess of sludge in a few hours. We were far enough into the building that I doubt the sound of the shots had carried out of it. But the cops on patrol in the park would notice the door the ghouls had torn off the building, probably sooner rather than later. I couldn't stay there. I found another way out of the building and hurried back toward my truck. I couldn't trust my tracking spell, obviously, which meant that I had to find Harry another way. Karen Murphy of Chicago PD might be able to find out if anyone had seen his car, but I had no way of knowing Harry would be in it, or even nearby. And even if I did find him, it was going to be hell convincing him of anything when a stranger walked up, told Harry that he was his brother, and asked him to abandon the case. First things first, I decided. I had to find him, or none of the rest of it would matter. I knew someone who could help. Chapter 4. Harry is one of the top wizards on the planet, and he lives in the basement. His boarding house is a little run down, but roomy. I guess the rent is cheap. His basement apartment is tiny, but the neighbors are elderly and quiet. He seems to like it. I've known him for years, and I still can't quite believe that he really keeps on living there. Personally, I think that's why he hasn't had more trouble at home. I don't think his enemies can bring themselves to believe it either. Maybe they figure it's a decoy he's constructed solely to give them somewhere obvious to attack, where he can lure them to their deaths. Certainly the ones who show up don't like the welcome they receive. The defensive spells around his home could charbroil a herd of charging buffalo. I used the crystal he'd given me to disarm his wards and the key he'd given me to unlock his door and let myself in. His apartment was spotlessly clean, as usual. He turned into a neat freak a few years ago for some reason, though he never talked about why. An enormous, shaggy, gray dog, 200 pounds of muscle and fur and white, sharp fangs, appeared from the little kitchen-equipped alcove and growled at me. "Whoa," I said, holding up my hands. "Mouse, it's me, Thomas." Mouse's growl cut off suddenly. His ears twitched back and forth, and he tilted his head one way and then the other, peering at me, his nose twitching as he sniffed. "Someone laid an illusion over me," I said. Harry had told me his dog was special and could understand human speech. I still wasn't sure whether he'd been pulling my leg when he said it. Harry's got a weird sense of humor sometimes. But speaking quietly to animals when they appear nervous is always a good idea, and I did not want Mouse deciding that I was a threat. He was a foo dog, and I'd seen him take on things no mortal animal could survive, much less overcome. "Look, boy, I think Harry might be in trouble. I need to talk to the skull." Mouse came over to me and sniffed at me carefully. Then he made a chuffing sound, padded over to one of the throw rugs on the apartment's floor, and dragged it to one side, revealing the lift-up trapdoor that led down to the sub-basement. I paced over to it and ruffled the dog's ears. "Thanks, boy." Mouse wagged his tail at me. A folding stepladder led down into my brother's laboratory, which I always pronounced with 5 syllables, just to give him a hard time. I unfolded it and went down, stopping as soon as I could see the whole place. You don't just wander around a wizard's lab. It's a bad idea. The place was piled high with God only knows what kind of horribly disturbing, rare, expensive, and inane junk. There was a lead box on one shelf in which he kept dust made from depleted uranium, for crying out loud. There was also an 8-foot-long scale model of the heart of the Chicago skyline on a table in the center of the room. It's obsessively detailed, down to models of trees that actually look like the trees they represent, and one of the downtown buildings that was recently demolished. It's a little bit creepy, actually. My brother's got a voodoo doll of the entire town. He also has a human skull that sits on its own wooden shelf between a pair of candles that have been burned down and replaced so many times that little volcano lumps of colored wax have formed at either end. There are romance paperbacks stacked up on either side of the skull, along with an old issue of Playboy from the 70s with Bo Derek on the cover and a long strip of scarlet ribbon. "Hey," I said. "Skull. Bob, isn't it?" The skull didn't move. I was going to feel really stupid if it turned out that Harry had been pulling my leg about the skull the whole time. My brother the ventriloquist. "Hey," I said. "Skull?" "Look, it's me, Thomas. I know I don't look like Thomas, but it's me. Harry's in trouble, and I need your help to go get him out of it." There was a tiny flicker of orange lights in one of the eye sockets of the skull. Then the flicker grew brighter and was joined by a second in the other socket. The skull twitched on the shelf, turning a little toward me, and said,
"Holy clayface, Batman, what happened to you?"
I chewed on my bottom lip for a second, debating on what to tell the skull. I knew that Bob was Harry's lab assistant and technical advisor in matters magical, that he was some sort of spirit who resided inside the skull and not a mortal being in his own right. All the same, he was beholden to Harry, and whatever Bob knew, Harry could potentially learn. "There isn't much I can tell you," I said. "Harry's new client isn't what she appears to be. I was trying to warn him. She tricked me into following her and did this to my face. I think she did it to make it harder for me to warn Harry about her."
"Uh-huh," Bob said. "What do you want from me?"
"Help me get this thing off my face, then help me find Harry so I can get him off this case before he gets hurt." Bob snorted.
"Yeah, right."
I frowned. "What, you think I'm lying to you?"
"Look, Thomas," the skull said, its tone patently patronizing. "I acknowledge you're cool beyond cool. You're good-looking, you get all the girls, and you send naked chicks to Harry's apartment dressed in only bits of red ribbon, all of which I admire in a person, but, you're still kind of a vampire, from a house of vampires, famous for being mind-benders, no less."
I ground my teeth. "You think someone's controlled me into doing this?"
"I think that, generally speaking, you don't have secrets from your brother, man," Bob said, yawning. "And besides, once Harry gets onto a case for a client, he doesn't come off it. He's like a tick, only his head doesn't come off quite as easy, and there's less chance of him giving you an infection."
"This is important, Bob," I told him.
"So is finding lost children," Bob said. "Or at least it is to Harry. I thought it might be because then their mother would be all appreciative and jump into bed with them. But apparently it's one of those morality things. Finding kids hits some kind of good versus evil hot button in his head."
That's what Lara had meant when she said the Stygian had taken a child. Crap. Now I could see the Stygian sisterhood's plan. And if I didn't stop them, stop Harry, the Oblivion War could be lost in a night.
"Damn it," I growled. "Bob, I need the help. I need you to do this." "Sorry, Chief," Bob said. "Don't work for you. Harry tells me different. That's a different story."
"But he's in trouble," I said.
"So you say, but you aren't offering me any details, which makes it sound fishy."
"Because if I gave you any details, they might get back to Harry, and he might be in even more trouble than he is right now." Bob stared at me for a second, and he said,
"I hereby promote you from mackerel to tuna fish."
"Okay," I said, thinking. Bob was a spirit. Such beings were bound by their words and promises, by the contracts they made with mortals. "Okay, look. You serve Harry, right?"
"Yep."
"If I give you this information," I said, "and if, in your judgment, his possession of this information could prove detrimental to his well-being, I want you to swear to me that you will keep it from him or anyone else who asks you about it."
"Okay," Bob said, drawing out the word with tremendous skepticism.
"If you do that," I said, "I'll tell you. If you can't, I won't. And bad things are going to happen." The skull's eye lights brightened with what looked surprisingly like curiosity.
"Okay, okay, I'll bite. You have a bargain. I do so swear it to you, vampire."
I took a deep breath and glanced around. If another Venator knew what I was doing, they'd put a bullet in my head without thinking twice. "Have you ever heard of the Oblivion War?"
"No," the skull said promptly.
"For a reason," I said. "Because it's a war being waged for the memory of mankind."
"Ah,"
Bob said.
"What?" I sighed and brushed my gloved hand back over my hair. Look, you know that for the most part, the old gods have grown less powerful over the years, or have changed as they were incorporated into other beliefs.
Sure, Bob said. There hasn't been a First Church of Marduk for a while now. But Tiamat got an illustration in the Monster Manual, and had that role in that cartoon, so she's probably better off.
Okay, I said. I'm not sure exactly what you're talking about, but generally speaking, you're right. Beings like Tiamat needed a certain amount of mortal belief to connect them to the mortal world. The eyelids brightened.
Ah, the skull said. I get it. If no one remembers some has-been god, there's no connection left. It can't remain in the mortal world.
Right, I said quietly. And we're not just talking about pagan gods. We're talking about things the people of today have no words for, no concept to adequately define. Demons of such appetites and fury that the only way mortals in some parts of the world survived them at all was with the help of some of those early gods. Demons who had to be stopped permanently.
You can't destroy a primal spiritual entity, Bob mused. Even if you disperse it, it will just reform in time.
But you can forget them, I said. Shut them away, leave them forever lost, outside the mortal world and unable to do harm. You can consign them to oblivion. Bob made a whistling sound. What the hell? How? He doesn't have any lips.
Ballsy, Bob admitted. I mean, fighting a war like that. The more people you brought in to fight on your side, the more the information would spread, and the stronger a hold the demons would have.
So you'd have to control who had the information. You'd have to lock that down hard. Very, I said. I know there are fewer than 200 Venatori in the world, but we're organized in cells. I only know one other Venator.
Venatori? Bob said. There's like 5,000 of those dried-up old prunes. They've been helping the Council fight the war, remember?
I waved a hand. Those are the Venatori Umbrorum.
Yeah, Bob said. The Hunters of the Shadows.
One way to translate their name, I said. And it's the one they believe is correct. But it's more accurate to call them the Shadows of the Hunters. They don't know it, but we founded them. Gave them their store of knowledge. Used them to gather information, to help us keep an eye on things. And their camouflage, too, to make our enemies have to work a little harder to find us.
Enemies, right, Bob said. A war has to have two sides.
I nodded. Or more. There are a lot of people interested in the old demons. They're weak compared to what they once were, but there's still a route to power. Cults, priests, societies, individual lunatics. They're trying to keep the demons nailed to this world. We're trying to stop them. I shook my head. The Oblivion War has been going on for more than 5,000 years. Sometimes decades will pass without a single battle being fought. Sometimes it all goes insane.
How many demons have you guys cut off?
Bob asked brightly. Then he chirped.
Oh, I guess you wouldn't know, would you? If you cacked him, you don't even remember him.
Yeah, I said.
Kind of a thankless way to fight a war.
Tell me about it, I said. This is secret stuff, Bob. Just knowing it creates a kind of resonance in the mind. If someone knows to look for it, they can see it. If Harry finds out about the war, and anyone from either side realizes that he's aware,
the bad guys will assume he's a Venator, or a rival, and kill him, Bob said, his manner suddenly sober. And the Venatori will assume he's a threat like the rest of the nutballs. They'll either consider him a security risk and kill him, or impress him into joining their army. And he's already fighting one war.
Yeah, I said.
Bob said, one wonders why they won't do the same thing to me.
You aren't mortal, I said. Your knowledge won't bind anything to this world. The skull somehow looked reassured.
Well, that's true. Tell me about this client that's with my boss.
You know about the Prosthanos Society? I asked.
Bunch of lunatics in the Baltic region, Bob replied immediately. They lop off their bits and pieces and replace them with grafts from inhuman sources, demons and ghouls and such,
patchwork immortality.
I nodded. The Stygian sisterhood does the same thing, only with their psyches instead of with their physical bodies. They slice out the parts of their human personalities they don't want and replace them with pieces torn from inhuman minds.
Cheery, Bob leered. Sorority, huh? They hop?
It's generally advantageous, I said, so for the most part, yes. They're dedicated to the service of a number of old demon goddesses, whom they're trying to keep in the world through the publication of a book of rituals called the Lexicon Malos.
So, the skull said, hot girl comes into Harry's office. He drools on her shoes, acts like an idiot, and doesn't take her up on her offer to do morally questionable things to him right then and there.
I said, I'm not sure if,
being a stupid hero, he tells her not to worry, that he'll find her obvious sob story decoy, I mean lost child. Only when he does find the kid, he finds this book of rituals, too.
And being a stalwart warden of the White Council now, I said.
Bob snorted. He'll take them this book of dangerous rituals anyone could use, and the Council will do with it what they did with the Necronomicon in order to defuse it.
I nodded. They publish it, because they think that by making the rituals available to every nut who wants to try them, the power that comes out of them will be so diffused that it will never amount to any harm.
Only the real danger isn't the rituals, Bob said, but the knowledge of the beings behind them.
And we might never be rid of them, just as we'll never be rid of the fairies. Bob looked suddenly wistful.
You were trying to ditch the fairies?
The Venatori tried, yes, I said. But the G-Men stop us cold.
G-Men? What, like the government? Bob asked. Like the Men in Black?
Like Gutenberg and the Grimms, I replied. Bob narrowed his eyelids for a moment, apparently in thought.
This Stygian hottie, she laid a trap for you. She knew who you were and what you'd do.
I've crossed swords with the Sisterhood before. They know me. I shook my head. I've got no idea why she messed up my face instead of killing me, though.
Because Dresden would have sensed it, Bob said promptly.
Huh?
Murdering someone with magic? It leaves an odor, and there isn't a body spray on earth that can hide it completely so soon after a kill. If Harry got close enough to sense a whiff of black magic on her, there wouldn't be any way she could pretend to be a damsel in distress.
He'd still be able to tell she was a practitioner.
Only if he actually touched her, Bob said. And even then, if she's significantly different from a normal human, mentally, it'll alter the sense of her aura. Besides, sensing a little tingle of magical potential in a client is a whole lot different than realizing that she's spattered in supernatural gore.
I get it. So instead, she changed my face.
Technically, she didn't change it, the skull said. It's an illusion. You're still you under there. The question is, why would she do that, particularly?
I frowned. To slow me down, I said, thinking it through. It didn't take me long to figure out what the Stygian had in mind, and I clenched my teeth in frustration. Oh, empty night. She's told Harry that there's a villain in the piece. She's shown him the picture of the bad man who took the poor kid, I gestured at my face, and she's made me look like him.
Damn, Bob said, admiration in his tone. That's sneaky. Harry's awfully quick on the draw these days. If you mosey up, he might not give you a chance to explain anything.
I sighed. The kind of day I'm having, he probably wouldn't. Are you going to help me or not?
Answer me one more question, the skull said, quieter now.
Okay.
Why, he asked. Why would vampires be a part of this? Why would something that eats people be interested in saving humanity from devouring demon gods?
I snorted. You want me to tell you that it's because in our secret hearts we long to be heroes? Or that deep down there's something in us that cries out for humanity, for redemption? I shook my head and smiled at him, showing teeth. At the end of the day, because we don't like competition.
Finally, Bob said with a roll of his eyelids. A motive I can understand. Okay.
Okay. The skull turned on its shelf to face the table.
I can show you how to find Harry, but the first thing we do is fix your face. Come on in, let me get a better look.
Mnemonic lightning flashed and boomed between my ears, and I felt myself smile. No, I said.
The skull tilted slightly to one side, watching me. No. No. I've got a better idea. Chapter 5. The skull tried to explain why the tracking spell he showed me was going to work when my own had failed, but about 5 seconds into the technical talk, I started substituting blah, blah, blah for everything he was saying. I'm not a wizard, okay? I'm a cheap hack. I don't care why it works, as long as it works. The Stygian had staged her little charade in a warehouse down in Hammond. When I caught up to my brother, he and the Stygian were lurking in an alley across the street from the warehouse, watching the place. The Stygian was playing her part, that of the frightened, nervous female, anxious with the need to bring her offspring safely home again. She was a reasonably good actress, too, for someone with so little humanity. She was probably a couple of centuries old. She'd had time to get in some practice. I went up the side of the building adjacent to the warehouse so that I could get a look at the place, too. There were a couple more ghouls guarding the building, wearing the brown uniforms of private security personnel. They kept up a regular walking routine around the warehouse's exterior and interior, and they weren't bothering to so much as glance up at the rooftop I was on. It was 5 floors up with no fire escape and nothing but bricks to hold on to. Why should they? I paced down to the back side of the warehouse, where Harry and the Stygian couldn't spot me, waited until the pacing ghouls were both out of sight, and then leapt the 40 feet or so from my rooftop to the roof of the warehouse. I landed in a roll in near complete silence and froze for a long moment, waiting to see if anyone raised an outcry. No one did. I hadn't been spotted. I settled down to wait. Harry made his move sometime between 3 and 4 in the morning, when the guards were most likely to be bored, tired, and convinced that nothing was going to happen tonight, and when there would be the fewest possible witnesses or innocent bystanders. From the front of the warehouse came his resonant baritone, crying out one of those pretend Latin spell incantations he uses. There was a flash of light, a boom like thunder, and a crash of something slamming into sheet metal with the force of a cannonball. Scratch one ghoul. My brother hates the creatures with a passion so pure that it's almost holy. If his first attack hadn't killed the thing, he'd finish it off before long. I heard the other ghoul shriek as it began to transform. Once everyone's attention was on the attack at the front door, I went in through a skylight. The warehouse was stacked high with years of accumulated junk, consisting mostly of the remains of shipping crates, stacks of loading pallets, and broken boxes. An area in the center of the floor had been cleared, and the concrete had been heavily marked up with occult symbols painted in blood, around a table that was obviously intended to be an altar. A kid, a little boy, maybe 9 years old, was bound, hand and foot on the table, his face blotchy from crying. He was screaming and struggling against the ropes, but was firmly secured to the table. Harry cried out again. The glass in both windows of the front side of the warehouse exploded inward in a flash of scarlet light. Something that looked disturbingly like a severed arm went tumbling by the open doorway. I kept looking until I spotted it. The Lexicon Malos, a leather-bound book like a big old handwritten journal. Just the kind of impressive grimoire occult nutjobs like the Stygians are so giddy about. It rested on a little pedestal beside the table. It didn't actually have a flashing neon sign over it reading "Notice Me," but it was pretty close. I went hand over hand along the steel beam rafters until I got to one of the girders that ran down the wall. Then I slid down into the floor and hurried over to the altar and the pedestal. I opened the nylon backpack in my hands, stuffed the Lexicon Malos into it, zipped it closed, and then slid my arms through the shoulder straps. I could have bailed then. I suppose it would have been the smartest thing. Once the book was removed from the equation, the Stygian's entire operation was blown. Granted, she and the other members of the Sisterhood would try it again somewhere else, but they would have been stopped for the time being. But the bitch had messed with my brother. For the time being, wasn't good enough. Harry came through the front door of the warehouse, with the Stygian treading fearfully behind him, pretending to tremble. Tall, skinny, sharp-featured, and somewhat rough-looking, Harry wore his usual wizarding gear, the black leather duster. He carried a carved staff in his left hand, a shorter, more heavily carved rod in his right, and the tip of the rod glowed with a sullen red-orange flame. I was waiting for them. I had wrapped the dark red blanket around my shoulders and upper body like some sort of dramatic ceremonial garb. I stood over the child, a wicked-looking knife I'd found lying on the altar in hand, with my head thrown back and a sneer on my illusion-covered face.
"So," I boomed in my most overblown voice, "you have defeated my minions."
"You have got to be kidding me," my brother said, staring at me with an expression somewhere between bemusement and naked contempt. "I mean, Jesus, look at this place. I've seen high school plays with a higher production value than this."
"Silence,"
I thundered, pointing the knife at him. I had eyes only for the Stygian, in any case. She was staring at me with a look of blank surprise. "Serves you right, sweetheart. You shouldn't make up stories about imaginary villains until you're certain they won't come true."
"Who dares interrupt my..."
"Yeah, you know what?" Harry asked.
"Forzare!"
His staff snapped forward, and an invisible truck hit me at 30 miles an hour. I flew backward 30 feet or so and hit a stack of loading pallets. I went through them. That hurt. I hit the wall behind them. I did not go through it. That hurt even more. I landed, dazed, and wobbled to my feet with the help of my demon. No problem, I told myself. I'd planned to fall back to this position in any case, just not quite that vigorously. The circuit box for the building was on the wall, 2 feet to my left. I reached out and killed the lights.
"Crouch down!"
Harry shouted to the woman he thought he was protecting.
"Stay still!"
My demon and I adjusted to the darkness almost instantly. The Stygian had done the same. She had produced a wavy bladed dagger from nowhere and was running toward me on silent feet, her eyes narrowed and intent. I threw the prop knife I'd been holding when she was 10 feet away. She slipped to one side, and it went spinning through the air, striking sparks off the far wall. Her knife struck at me, but I slammed the edge of one hand against her forearm, knocking it away before it could do more than scratch me. I followed that with a pair of sharp blows to the body, driving her back a step, and then drew my kukri from beneath the red blanket robes, slashing at her head. I missed her, and the follow-up rake at her eyes that I made with my other hand failed to connect as well. In the background, Harry had his priorities straight. He'd brought forth a little light from his amulet and was cutting the child free from the makeshift altar. I felt my mouth stretch into a fierce grin.
"So smug,"
hissed the Stygian, her reptile eyes flat.
"But not for long."
She raised her voice into a terrified scream.
"Let me go! Don't touch me!"
Harry, holding the child over one shoulder in a fireman's carry, spun toward the sound, raising his blasting rod, and began hurrying toward me.
"Run, Venator," hissed the Stygian. "But the blood of the ancient mothers is in your veins now. Enjoy your last hours."
The nick on my arm, the tiny cut from the dagger, suddenly felt very cold. The book was out of Harry's hands. The child was safe. I fled the building. Chapter 6. The wound was poisoned. Without my demon, I don't think I would have lasted more than an hour. Even with its support, I was having trouble staying steady. The pain was horrible, and my whole body poured sweat, even as I shivered with cold. The hunger can usually overcome any kind of foreign substance, but while my demon might have been a powerful one, it was not well fed, and I'd been using it hard all night. It had little strength left with which to fight the poison. It was difficult, but I persevered for 3 hours. That's how long it took me to track the Stygian and catch her alone. The sweep of my kukri had missed her head, but not the hairs growing out of it. and while my grasping fingers had not found her eyes an instant later, they had snatched those hairs out of the air before they could fall. The tracking spell the skull had taught me had been good enough to let me find the Stygian, despite any countermeasures she might have taken. When she entered her hotel room, I was half an inch behind her. She never knew I was there until my lips touched the back of her neck, and I unleashed my demon upon her. She let out a sudden gasp as my hunger, starved for so long, rushed into her flesh. Though she might have had the mind and thoughts of a dozen alien beings, she had a mortal life force and a mortal body, a woman's body, and as I had told the skull, a rather lovely one at that. She tried to struggle for 5 or 6 seconds, until her nervous system succumbed to my hunger, until the first orgasm ripped a moan of equal parts ecstasy, need, and despair from her throat. I told her, my teeth gently finding her earlobe and my hands roaming. It won't hurt, I promise. She cried out in despair again as her body began moving in helpless acquiescence to desire, and my own reservations flickered and died before the raw, aching need of my hunger. I spend most of my life fighting my darker nature. Most of it. Not all of it. I bore the Stygian to the floor and fed her to my demon. Lara would help me get rid of the body. Chapter 7. A long, long shower and the cleansing force of the rising sun had been enough to wash away the illusion that had obscured my true features. I visited my brother at his office the next day. "How's business?" I asked him. He shook his head, scowling.
"You know what? I've been doing so much gopher work for the council and the wardens, I think I must be forgetting how to be a private eye."
"Why is that?"
"Oh, I went up against this complete joke of a bad guy yesterday," he said. "Kidnapper. I mean, you should have seen this loser. He was a joke."
"Uh-huh," I said.
"And somehow he manages to get away from me."
Harry shook his head.
"I mean, I got the kid back, no problem, but the little skeeve skated out on me."
"Maybe you're getting old." He glowered at me.
"The worst part is that the chick who hired me, it turns out, isn't even his mother. She was playing me all along. The kid's been missing for 3 days, and his real parents are trying to get the cops to freaking arrest me. After I pull him off a freaking sacrificial altar." "Okay, a cheesy, stupid sacrificial altar, but a sacrificial altar all the same."
"Where's the chick?" I asked.
"Who knows?"
Harry said, exasperated.
"She's gone. Stiffed me, too. And good luck trying to get the kid's parents to pay me for the investigation and rescue. There's a better chance of electing a libertarian president."
"The perils of the independent entrepreneur," I said. "You hungry?"
"You buying?"
"I'm buying." He stood up.
"I'm hungry."
He put on his coat and walked with me toward the door, shaking his head.
"I tell you, Thomas, sometimes I feel completely unappreciated."
I found myself smiling. "Wow," I said. "What's it like?" The Warrior. Novelette from Mean Streets. Takes place between Small Favor and Turncoat, and before Last Call. Once upon a time, when moving into a new neighborhood, I spent a few days meeting the new neighbors. Nothing big, just visits to say hello, introduce myself to the other family with children my son's age, another family with a high school-age daughter who often babysat for the other families on the street, the usual sort of thing. I had a bunch of innocuous interactions with them that didn't look like anything special at the time. Fast forward 5 years. Over the next few years, I came to learn that some of the most inane, unimportant little things I had done or said in that time had impacted several of my neighbors in enormous ways. Not necessarily good or bad, but significantly, and generally in a positive fashion, or so it seemed to me. If I'd chosen different words to speak, or timed my actions only slightly differently, it might well have altered their lives, and if I hadn't been paying close attention, I might not have realized it had happened at all. It was my first real-life lesson in the law of unintended consequences, and the basis of my belief that big, important things are built from small and commonplace things, and that even our little acts of petty everyday good or evil have a cumulative effect on our world. A lot of religions make a distinction between light and darkness and paint portraits of dramatic battles between their champions. But maybe the fight on the ground is a lot more common than we ever really think. It happens every day, and a lot of the time we might not even be aware that it's going on, until 5 years later, I guess. Our smallest actions and choices matter. They tell us about who we are. That was the idea I tried to carry into The Warrior. That, and the idea that what seems like a good thing or a bad thing might not be either, seen from another point of view. Many readers were upset with Michael's fate at the end of Small Favor. How horrible that a character who was basically so decent got handed such a horrible fate, being shot and crippled for life by the champions of hell itself. What a tragedy that he couldn't continue the fight. Judge for yourself how tragic it was for him. I sat down next to Michael and said, "I think you're in danger." Michael Carpenter was a large, brawny man, though he was leaner now than in all the time I'd known him. Months in bed and more months in therapy had left him a shadow of himself, and he had never added all the muscle back on. Even so, he looked larger and more fit than most, his salt and pepper hair and short beard going heavier on the salt these days. He smiled at me. That hadn't changed. If anything, the smile had gotten deeper and more steady. "Danger," he said. "Heavens." I leaned back on the old wooden bleachers at the park and scowled at him. "I'm serious." Michael paused to shout a word of encouragement at the second baseman, or was that base person, on his daughter Alicia's softball team. He settled back onto the bleachers. They were covered in old peeling green paint, and it clashed with his powder blue and white shirt, which matched the uniform t-shirts of the girls below. It said "Coach" in big blue letters. "I brought your sword. It's in the car." "Harry," he said, unruffled, "I'm retired. You know that." "Sure," I said, reaching into my coat. "I know that, but the bad guys apparently don't." I drew out an envelope and passed it to him. Michael opened it and studied its contents. Then he replaced them, put the envelope back on the bench beside me, and rose. He started down onto the field, leaning heavily on the wooden cane that went everywhere with him now. Nerve damage had left one of his legs pretty near perfectly rigid, and his hip had been damaged as well. It gave him a rolling gait. I knew he couldn't see out of one of his clear, honest eyes very well anymore either. He took charge of the practice in the quiet, confident way he did everything, drawing smiles and laughter from his daughter and her teammates. They were obviously having fun. It looked good on him. I looked down at the envelope and wished I couldn't imagine the photos contained inside it quite so clearly. They were all professional, clear. Michael walking up the handicap access ramp to his church, Michael opening a door for his wife, Charity, Michael loading a big bucket of softballs into the back of the Carpenter family van, Michael at work wearing a yellow hard hat, pointing up at a half-finished building as he spoke to a man beside him. The pictures had come in the mail to my office with no note and no explanation, but their implications were ugly and clear. My friend, the former Knight of the Cross, was in danger. It took half an hour for the softball practice to end, and then Michael rolled back over to me. He stood staring up at me for a moment before he said, "The sword has passed out of my hands. I can't take it up again, especially not for the wrong reason. I won't live in fear, Harry." "Could you maybe settle for living in caution?" I asked. "At least until I know more about what's going on?" "I don't think his plan is for me to die now," he replied calmly. It was never hard to tell when Michael was talking about the Almighty. He could insert capital letters into spoken words. I'm not sure how. "What happened to 'no man knows the day or the hour'?" I asked. He gave me a wry smile. "You're taking that out of context." I shrugged. "Michael, I'd like to believe in a loving, just God who looks out for everyone, but I see a lot of people get hurt who don't seem to deserve it. I don't want you to become one of them." "I'm not afraid, Harry." I grimaced. I'd figured he might react like this, and I'd come prepared to play dirty. "What about your kids, man? What about Charity? If someone comes for you, they aren't going to be particular about what happens to the people around you." I'd seen him display less expression while being shot. His face turned pale and he looked away from me.
What do you have in mind? He asked after a moment.
I'm going to lurk and hover, I told him. Maybe catch our photographer before things go any farther.
Whether or not I want you to do it, he said.
Well, yes. He shook his head at me and gave me a tight smile. Thank you, Harry, but no thank you. I'll manage. Michael's home was an anomaly so close to the city proper, a fairly large old colonial house, complete with a white picket fence and a yard with trees in it. It had a quiet, solid sort of beauty. It was surrounded by other homes, but they never seemed quite as pleasant, homey, or clean as Michael's house. I knew he did a lot of work to keep it looking nice. Maybe it was that simple. Maybe it was a side effect of being visited by archangels and the like. Or maybe it was all in the eye of the beholder. I'm pretty sure there won't ever be a place like that for me. Michael had given a couple of the girls, young women, I suppose, a ride home in his white pickup. So it had taken us a while to get there, and twilight was heavy on the city. I wasn't making any particular secret about tailing them, but I wasn't riding his back bumper either, and I don't think either of them had noticed my beat-up old VW. Michael and Alicia got out of the car and went into the house while I drove a slow lap around their block, keeping my eyes peeled. When I didn't spot any imminent maniacs or anticipatory fiends about to pounce, I parked a bit down the street and walked toward Michael's place. It happened pretty fast. A soccer ball went bouncing by me, a small person came pelting after it, and just as it happened, I heard the crunchy hiss of tires on the street somewhere behind me and very near. I have long arms, and it was a good thing. I grabbed the kid, who must have been 7 or 8, about half a second before the oncoming car hit the soccer ball and sent it sailing. Her feet went flying out ahead of her as I swung her up off the ground, and her toes missed hitting the car's fender by maybe 6 inches. The car, one of those fancy new hybrids that run on batteries part of the time, went by in silence, without the sound of the motor to give any warning. The driver, a young man in a suit, was jabbering into a cell phone that he held to his ear with one hand. He never noticed. As he reached the end of the block, he turned on his headlights. I turned to find the child, a girl with inky black hair and pink skin, staring at me with wide, dark eyes, her mouth open and uncertain. She had a bruise on her cheek, a couple of days old. "Hi," I said, trying to be as unthreatening as I could. I had limited success. Tall, severe-looking men in long black coats who need a shave are challenged that way. "Are you all right?" She nodded her head slowly.
"Am I in trouble?"
I put her down. Not for me, but I heard that moms can get kind of worked up about—
"Courtney!"
gasped a woman's voice. And a woman I presumed to be the child's mother came hurrying from the nearest house. Like the child, she had black hair and very fair skin. She had the same wary eyes, too. She extended her hand to the little girl and then pulled her until Courtney stood behind her mother. She peeked around at me.
"What do you think you're doing?"
she demanded, or tried to. It came out as a nervous question.
"Who are you?"
"Just trying to keep your little girl from becoming a victim of the Green Movement," I said. She didn't get it. Her expression changed, as she probably wondered something along the lines of, "Is this person a lunatic?" I get that a lot. "There was a car, ma'am," I clarified. "She didn't see it coming."
"Oh,"
the woman said.
"Oh, thank you.
"Sure." I frowned at the girl. "You okay, sweetheart? I didn't give you that bruise, did I?"
"No," she said. "I fell off my bike."
"Without hurting your hands," I noted. She stared at me for a second before her eyes widened and she hid behind her mother a little more. Mom blinked at me and then at the child. Then she nodded to me, took her daughter by the shoulders, and frog-marched her toward the house without another word. I watched them go and then started back toward Michael's place. I kicked Courtney's soccer ball back into her yard on the way. Charity answered the door when I knocked. She was of an age with Michael, though her golden hair hid fairly well any strands of silver that might have shone. She was tall and broad-shouldered for a woman, and I'd seen her crush more than one inhuman skull when one of her children was in danger. She looked tired. A year of seeing her husband undergoing intensely difficult physical therapy can do that, I guess. But she also looked happy.
Our personal Cold War had entered a state of detente of late, and she smiled to see me. "Hello, Harry. Surprise lesson? I think Molly went to bed early." "Not exactly," I said, smiling. "Thought I'd just stop by to visit." Charity's smile didn't exactly vanish, but it got cautious. "Really?"
"Harry!"
screamed a little voice, and Michael's youngest son, of the same name, flung himself into the air, trusting me to catch him. Little Harry was around Courtney's age, generally regarded me as something interesting to climb on. I caught him and gave him a noisy kiss on the head, which elicited a giggle and a protesting, "Yuck!" Charity shook her head wryly. "Well, come in. Let me get you something to drink. Harry, he's not a jungle gym. Get down." Little Harry developed spontaneous deafness and scrambled up onto my shoulders as we walked into the living room. Michael and Alicia, his dark-haired, quietly serious daughter, were just coming in from the garage after putting away softball gear.
"Papa!"
little Harry shouted and promptly plunged forward off my shoulders, arms outstretched to Michael. He leaned forward and caught him, though I saw him wince and exhale tightly as he did it. My stomach rolled uncomfortably in sympathy. "Alicia," Charity said. Her daughter nodded, hung her ball cap on a wooden peg by the door, and took little Harry from Michael, tossing him up into the air and catching him, much to the child's protesting laughter. "Come on, Squirt, time for a bath."
"Leech!"
Harry shouted, and immediately started climbing on his sister's shoulders, babbling about something to do with robots. Michael smiled as he watched them exit.
"I asked Harry to dinner tonight," he told Charity, kissing her on the cheek.
"Did you?" she said, in the exact same tone she'd used on me at the door. Michael looked at her and sighed. Then he said,
"My office."
We went into the study Michael used as his office, more cluttered than it had been before, now that he was actually using it all the time, and closed the door behind us. Without a word, I took out the photos I'd received and showed them to Charity. Michael's wife was no dummy. She looked at them one at a time, in rapid succession, her eyes blazing brighter with every new image. When she spoke, her voice was cold.
"Who took these?"
"I don't know yet," I told her, "though Nicodemus's name does sort of leap to mind."
"No," Michael said quietly. "He can't harm me or my family anymore. We're protected."
"By what?" I asked.
"Faith," he said simply.
That would be a maddening answer under most circumstances, but I'd seen the power of faith in action around my friend, and it was every bit as real as the forces I could manage. Former presidents get a detail of Secret Service to protect them. Maybe former Knights of the Cross had a similar retirement package, only with more seraphim.
"Oh. You are going to get to the bottom of this?"
Charity asked. "That's the idea," I said. "It might mean I intrude on you all a little."
"Harry," Michael said, "there's no need for that."
"Don't be ridiculous," Charity replied, turning to Michael. She took his hand, very gently, though her tone stayed firm. "And don't be proud."
He smiled at her. "It isn't a question of pride."
"I'm not so sure," she said quietly. "Father Forthill said we were only protected against supernatural dangers. If there's something else afoot, you've made so many enemies. We have to know what's happening."
"I often don't know what's happening," Michael said. "If I spent all my time trying to find out, there wouldn't be enough left to live in. This is more than likely being done for the sole purpose of making us worried and miserable."
"Michael," I said quietly, "one of the best ways I know to counter fear is with knowledge." He tilted his head, frowning gently at me.
"You say you won't live in fear. Fine. Let me poke around and shine a light on things so we know what's going on. If it turns out to be nothing, no harm done."
"And if it isn't?" Charity asked. I kept a surge of quiet anger out of my voice and expression as I looked at her levelly.
"No harm gets done to you and yours."
Her eyes flashed and she nodded her chin once.
"Honey," Michael sighed.
Charity stared at him. Michael might have slain a dragon, but he knew his limits. He lifted a hand in acceptance and said,
"Why don't you make up the guest bedroom?"
By a little after 9, the Carpenter household was almost entirely silent. I had been shown into the little guest room kept at the end of an upstairs hallway. It was really Charity's sewing room, and was all but filled with colorful stacks of folded fabric, some of them in clear plastic containers, some of them loose.
There was room around a little table with a sewing machine on it, and just barely enough space to get to the bed. I had recuperated from injuries there before. One thing was new. There was a very fine layer of dust on the sewing machine. Huh. I sat down on the bed and looked around. It was a quiet, warm, cheerful little room, almost manically so, now that I thought about it. Everything was soft and pleasant and ordered, and it took me maybe 6 or 7 whole seconds to realize that this room had been Charity's haven. How many days and nights must she have been worried about Michael, off doing literally God only knew what, against foes so terrible that no one but he could have been trusted to deal with them? How many times had she wondered if it would be a solemn Father Forthill who came to the door, instead of the man she loved? How many hours had she spent in this well-lit room, working on making warm, soft things for her family, while her husband carried Amorakius's cold, bright steel into the darkness? And now there was dust on the sewing machine. Michael had nearly been killed out there on that island. He had been crippled, forced by his injuries to lay aside the holy sword, along with the nearly invisible deadly war that went with it, and he was happier than I'd ever seen him. Maybe the Almighty worked in mysterious ways after all. Another thought occurred to me as I sat there pondering. Whoever had sent those pictures hadn't sent them to Michael. He'd sent them to me. What if I'd put Michael and his family into real danger by showing up? What if I'd somehow reacted in exactly the way I'd been meant to react? I grimaced around the cheerful room. So much for sleep. I got up and padded back downstairs in my sock feet to raid the fridge, and while I was in the kitchen munching on an impromptu cold cuts sandwich, I saw a shadow move past the back window. I had several options, but none of them were real appetizing. I settled for the one that might accomplish the most. I turned and padded as quickly and quietly as I could to the front door, slipped out, and snuck around the side of the house in the direction that would, I hoped, bring me up behind the intruder. A quick spat of rain had made the grass wet, and the night had grown cool enough to make my instantly soaked socks uncomfortable. I ignored them and went padding through the grass, keeping to the side of the house and watching all around me. The backyard was empty. I got an itchy feeling on the back of my neck and continued my circle. Had I given myself away somehow? Was the intruder even now circling just the way I was, hoping to sneak up on me? I took longer steps and stayed as quiet as I knew how, which was pretty darn quiet. I had developed my skulking to professional levels over the years. And as I rounded the corner, I spotted the intruder, a dark form hurrying down the sidewalk past Courtney's house. I couldn't follow him without being spotted pretty quickly, unless I cheated, which I promptly did. My ability to throw up a veil wasn't anything to write home about, but it ought to be good enough to hide me from view on a dark night, on a heavily shadowed street. I focused on my surroundings, on drawing the light and shadow around me in a cloak, and watched my own vision dim and blur somewhat as I did. I half wished I'd woken up Molly. The kid is a natural at subtle stuff like veils. She can make you as invisible as Paris Hilton's ethical standards, and you can still see out with no more impediment than a pair of mildly tinted sunglasses. But since it was me doing the job, I was probably just sort of indistinct and blurry, and my view of the street was like something seen through dark, thin fabric. I kept track of the pale concrete of the sidewalk and the movement of the intruder against the background of shadowy shapes and blurry bits of light, and walked softly. The intruder crept down the street and then quickly crouched down beside my old Volkswagen, the Blue Beetle. It took him maybe 5 seconds to open the lock, reach into the car, and draw out the long, slender shape of a sheathed sword. He must have come to the house first and circled it to determine where I was. He could have spotted my staff, which I'd left resting against the wall by the front door, when he looked into the kitchen window. And I was pretty sure it was a he I was dealing with, too. The movement of his arms and legs was brusque, choppy, masculine. I took a few steps to one side and picked up Courtney's soccer ball. Then I approached within a few yards and tossed it up in a high arc. It came down with a rattling thump on the Blue Beetle's hood. Lurky Boy twitched, twisting his upper body toward the sound and freezing, and I hit him in a diving tackle with my body as rigid as a spear, all of my weight behind one shoulder, trying to drive it right through his spine and out his chest.
He was completely unprepared for it and went down hard, driven to the sidewalk with a woof of expelled air. I grabbed him by the hair so that I could introduce his forehead to the sidewalk, but his hair was cut nearly military short and I didn't have a good grip. He twisted and got me in the floating rib with an elbow, and I wasn't in a good enough position to keep him from getting out from under me and scrambling away, the sheathed weapon still in hand. I focused my will, flicked a hand at him, and spat,
"Forzare!"
Unseen force lashed out at the back of his knees, and hit the mystic equivalent of a brick wall. There was a burst of twinkling, shifting lights, and he let out a croaking sound as he kept running. Something that glowed like a dying ember fell to the sidewalk. I pushed myself up to pursue him, slipped on the wet grass next to the sidewalk, and rolled my ankle painfully. By the time I'd gotten to my feet again, he was too far away for me to catch, even if my ankle had been steady. A second later, he hopped a fence and was out of sight. I was left there, standing beside my car, on one foot, while neighborhood dogs sent up a racket. I gimped forward and looked down at the glowing embers of the thing he'd dropped. It was an amulet, its leather cord snapped in the middle. It looked as though it had been a carving of wood and ivory, but it was scorched almost completely black, so I couldn't be certain. I picked it up, wrinkling my nose at the smell. Then I turned back to the car and closed the open door. After that, I untwisted the piece of wire that held the trunk closed, picked up a blanket-wrapped bundle, and went back to Michael's place. Morning on a school day in the Carpenter household is like Southampton just before June 6, 1944. There's a lot of yelling, running around, and organizing transport, and no one seems to be exactly sure what's going on. Or maybe that was just me, because by a little before 8, all the kids were trooping out to their bus stop, led by Alicia, the senior school child.
"So he grabbed the sword and ran?"
Molly asked, sipping coffee. She apparently had a cold, and her nose was stuffy and bright pink. My apprentice was her mother's daughter, tall and blonde and too attractive for me ever to be entirely comfortable, even wrapped up in a pink fluffy robe and flannel PJs with her hair a mess. "Give me some credit," I said, unwrapping the blanket-wrapped bundle and producing Amorakios. He thought he took the sword. Michael frowned at me as he put margarine on his toast.
"I thought you told me the sword was best hidden in plain sight."
"I've been getting paranoid in my old age," I replied, munching on a bit of sausage. I blinked at the odd taste and looked at him. "Turkey," Michael said mildly. "It's better for me."
"It's better for everyone," Charity said firmly, "including you, Harry."
"Gee," I said, "thanks." She gave me an arch look.
"Can't you just use the amulet to track him down?"
"Nope," I said, putting some salt on the turkey sausage. "Tell her why not, Grasshopper." Molly spoke through a yawn.
"It caught on fire. Fire's a purifying force. Wiped out whatever energy was on the amulet that might link back to the owner."
She blinked watery eyes.
"Besides, we don't need it."
Michael frowned at her. "He took the decoy," I said, smiling, "and I know how to find that." "Unless he's gotten rid of it or taken steps to make it untraceable," Michael said in a patient, reasonable tone. "After all, he was evidently prepared with some sort of defensive measure against your abilities."
"Different situation entirely," I said. "Tracking someone by using one of their personal possessions depends upon following a frequency of energy inherently unstable and transient. I actually have a piece of the decoy sword, and the link between the two objects is much more concrete. It'll take a heck of a serious countermeasure to stop me from finding it."
"But you didn't trail him last night?" Charity asked.
I shook my head. I didn't know where I'd have been going. I wasn't prepared, and since apparently someone is interested in the swords, I didn't want to go off and leave
you.
"The sword?"
"Unprotected."
"Here," I finished.
"What about the other one?" Michael asked quietly.
Phytilochius, brother sword to Michael's former blade, currently rested in a cluttered basket in my basement, next to a heavy locked gun safe that was warded with a dozen dangerous defensive spells. Hopefully anyone looking to take it would open the safe first and get a face full of boom. My lab was behind a screen of defensive magic, which was in turn behind an outer shell of defensive magic that protected my apartment. Plus, there was my dog, Mouse, 200 pounds of fur and muscle, who didn't take kindly to hostile visitors. "It's safe," I told him. "After breakfast, I'll track Buzzcut Guy down, have a little chat with him, and we'll put this whole thing to bed."
"Sounds simple," Michael said.
It could happen. Michael smiled, his eyes twinkling. Buzz, as it turned out, wasn't a dummy. He ditched the decoy sword in a dumpster behind a fast food joint, less than 4 blocks from Michael's place. Michael sat behind the wheel of his truck, watching as I stood hip-deep in trash and dug for the sword. "You sure you don't want to do this part?" I asked him sourly. "I would, Harry."